Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
There was nothing really that I didn't think that I could do. Like, I wanted to leave home, so I left. I wanted to go to the US, so I did. I wanted to work in nightclubs, so I did. I wanted to, you know, model, so I did. And it was just kind of like I'd make the decision and then I'd figure out how to do it.
This is Property Investory, where we talk to successful property investors to find out more about their stories, mindset, and strategies. I'm Tyrone Shum, and in this episode, we're speaking with Ludwina Dogovic, founder of The Room Exchange. We'll talk about the incredible twists and turns of her storied life, taking her from country New South Wales to New York City, plus how she's managed to be her own boss for nearly 30 years and filling a gap to solve the Australian housing crisis. Dogovic has already had some career. She's worked around the world in nightclubs, founded multiple companies, worked in TV production, and hosted a record-breaking podcast. Her latest endeavor, The Room Exchange, was created to solve the problem of Australia's housing crisis. There's over 13.5 million unused spare rooms in 10 million homes across the country. It's Australia's first verified house-sharing platform and is already a multi-award-winning company as an Australian Small Business Award finalist in 2019. Unsurprisingly, Dogovic's typical day is never the same.
We're still at the moment, because of post-COVID, we lost a couple of years in COVID. So if you imagine, no one's opening up their front doors to house share at that time. So we've, in a way, had to go back to sort of like the starting phase, but not the startup phase, if that makes sense. So we had to rebuild the data, rebuild the brand, and make it, you know, more compatible with what's happening now. So there's still a bit of having to do the mundane, every day-to-day things of, you know, marketing and social to, you know, then having to make business decisions about, well, you know, finances and targets and data and, you know, all the things that go along with having shareholders and, you know, all the challenges that you have as a leader and a CEO. But when you still have a pretty small team where, you know, we've all sort of got a few multi-layers in terms of what we do. But I would say that generally there's at least a couple of interviews a week. I get a lot of media, which has been wonderful, but, you know, we've come at a time where something like The Room Exchange is really needed because we're in a rental crisis. So there's a lot of conversations that I'm having around that. I have my own podcast show as well, so interviewing there. So there's usually about three or four interviews a week all up. Communicating with my advisors and, you know, I'm talking a lot with government at the moment. We've made some major inroads with the Treasury of Victoria and various different aspects of government to put submissions in next year for the budget to, you know, get some regional areas piloted, as in specific geographical test ranges for The Room Exchange. That's been great. A lot of networking. Well, at least one networking event a week. I like to get out. I do a lot of networking on LinkedIn too. I have to say, I think I've pretty well nailed that one. But there is a key to it. And anyone who's listening, if you're just sending out cold messages and you expect me to respond, it's not going to happen. You know, you've got to have a bit of love, bit of connection, bit of care around it. And if you do that well, then that comes out. So it's a cross-section of things, but I'm very regimented in my day. Like, I know from the start of my day exactly what I'm going to be doing that day, but also the big things that I want to accomplish through the week. And I'm very calendar-driven. So if there's something where I need a chunk of time to put a document or proposal together, there's 2 hours that actually get wiped out in my calendar so no one can come in and book a call and take my time from me. So, and I'm also very aware of when I'm at my most alert and when I'm not. And so I categorize my activities throughout the day, depending on that. And a couple of days I go into Footscray. I've now got an office in there that I can go to a couple of days a week at the cotton mills, which is amazing. So it just gets me out of the house. But mostly I work from home because I do like the convenience of it. And I've always done it. And I manage the separation of home and business very well. So I don't find it, you know, a difficult thing to do. But I do like to get out sometimes as well. It's good for my mind.
As busy and varied as Dukovic's days are now, her road to get there is just as unique.
So I grew up in a little country town in New South Wales, little as in 500 people, like really little. It's an interesting upbringing. My brother and I were the only coloured kids in town, and I say that because that's how we were referred to, and plus a whole lot of other things. So my upbringing in this very small town with, I've been talking a lot about it this week, so I've actually been reflecting a lot on it. It was a very unusual upbringing. I wasn't raised with my Indian culture, wonderful mother and wonderful stepfather, but both white parents and, you know, my brother Tony and I. And it was just kind of like it was an upbringing where, you know, parents did the best that they could with the resources that they had. But it was part of that time when I don't think there was a real recognition of the importance of culture, particularly when you come from a different environment. So I was always kind of on the defensive as a kid, you know, constantly afraid, you know, very wary, very shy and very quiet, which is really interesting considering, you know, who I am. Who I became after I left home. But I think that's probably why music was my thing as a kid. I loved music, classical music, and I played a bunch of instruments and wanted to go to the music conservatorium, but it wasn't on the cards for me. So I finished school at the end of year 10, which you could do back then. And because I started school early, I was only 15, started working in a supermarket, left at six. But I started modelling when I was about 10. So I've always done some kind of work. There's always been something that I've always done. And some kind of performance as well, particularly with the music.
Dukovic's upbringing was full of interesting experiences which have shaped her into the woman she is today. However, looking back, some were definitely better than others.
I think that sort of helped me to sort of come out of myself a little bit and have some kind of ownership of self. But beyond that, there was a lot of insecurity, a lot of confusion, and just kind of, you know, just going day by day, really close with my siblings, great relationship there, lots of love in the house, but just a very unusual town, a very unusual town. And I go back now and it's like when I see some of the kids that used to give me a really hard time, thankfully they've come back and they've recognised the error of their ways, but at the time when you're very young, the impact can actually be quite devastating and harsh. I don't know if you've experienced, you know, or where you grew up, if you experienced a similar thing, but and it's still interesting. Like even up until just a couple of weeks ago, I experienced something which wasn't a direct form of racism, but it was an indirectly. And I'm a little slow on the uptake sometimes. I don't know if you are, but I go away and I went, I think she was just actually being really racist in it. And sometimes it can just be kind of really subdued and subtle. And it was just like, oh, gosh, the poor thing. She didn't even know what she did. You know, and I kind of had empathy for her because, you know, I'm at that stage, it just doesn't faze me anymore. But it's just interesting how it's kind of, it's those little heat buttons, I call them, you know, they get pressed and it's like, oh, where did that come from? That was from there, you know, from back home.
For Dukovic, the mixed bag of childhood was left in the past quickly. Her sense of adventure was just too strong.
I was 16 when I left home, had $200 in my pocket and a place to stay for a couple of weeks. But the thing, it's an interesting question you ask because I wonder often if it's because I was the firstborn and also too with the challenges that we face because of my childhood story, if that actually created this level of self-sufficiency and inner strength within myself. I look at all experiences, whether they're good or bad, and, you know, the impact that they have, and they can, the impact can be good even though it was a bad experience, right? And I can see that a lot of that has given me the ability to just be able to decide and do things for myself. I think the decision of leaving home when I was 16 was a key turning point in my life, because if I had the courage to do that, that was it was my first big reference point, is the way that I actually language it. So anything sort of beyond that then was like, if I can do that, then I can do this. And then obviously then the next reference point became bigger, and it became bigger and sort of went on from there. So I went to Sydney and I had somewhere to stay in Cronulla, and then I got a job at McDonald's just to do something, and then I went to some modelling agencies and started getting some work, and then I started working in the hospitality industry. And that was another huge turning point, because at the age of 17, and I know that I was underage, but, you know, hoo-ha, it was the 80s. I was working in a nightclub in Sydney, no longer exists now, but at the time in the 80s, it was all the big celebrities used to come. And because of my personality type, I was put in charge of looking after them. And what I mean by that is because I think because I grew up in a little country town and probably only saw three movies before I left, hadn't had this kind of like big world view. I was just like, oh, you're a person. If you're going to be nice to me, I'll be nice to you. And if you're not, I won't. It was just, you know, and so I wasn't fazed by the celebrity. There were no mobile phones or, you know, social media or anything back then. It was just, and I just enjoyed their company and they enjoyed mine. And so I had the opportunity to spend a lot of time with very successful people.
Dokovic started to hone her business skills on some of the world's most fascinating people in the most exotic places. But in her mind, it was just work. In a way, they were just customers.
And I was also very good at sales. I was able to get people to spend a lot of money on alcohol, and I used to make a lot of money in tips. And then when I was 19, I went to the US, and I spent, you know, a good 6 months in New York, and again, you know, around this circle of people as well. And so it was just, you know, I guess to then the level of confidence that I created by being in their company. Look, I don't think I was consciously aware of it at the time, Tyrone, but sort of looking back as I get asked these questions, it's like, yeah, I think that was that, you know, sort of making the connections. And as a result of it, there was nothing really that I didn't think that I could do. Like, I wanted to leave home, so I left. I wanted to go to the US, so I did. I wanted to work in nightclubs, so I did. I wanted to, you know, model, so I did. And it was just kind of like I'd make the decision and then I'd figure out how to do it. So I have this saying, a friend of mine, Chris, said it, and he's given me permission to write a book using the title, and I've bought the URL, just say yes and figure it out later. That's kind of my motto. So it's like I decide what it is that I want to do, and then I work out how to make that happen, as opposed to realizing that I don't have the resources to do it, so I can't.
Every job has its perks, but some jobs are on another level. Dukovic's nightclub career seemed to have it all.
I worked in, again, the coolest bar in New York at the time. It's in Manhattan. It was just like, you know, it was like 95% of the patrons were celebrities. So you'd remember George Michael. Yeah. He was a mate. Spent a bit of time with George. Mel Gibson used to hang out at the Cauldron quite a lot. Crazy man, that one. Look, he had a bungalow in Clovelly, which at the time we live in Clovelly, so my housemate and I, so he would come to the Cauldron when he came to Australia, and then, you know, there was just, I always knew everyone that came to the place, but, you know, look, it was at a time in his life where meeting celebrities at the time in their life where they hit their peak is really quite interesting. And that happened for Mel at the time. I met Mel and his wife. He's come in with his wife as well. You know, George Michael was just on the cusp of coming out. So he was just sort of moving away from Wham at the time. I met Andrew Ridgely once as well. Julian Lennon was probably the one where I was. My first celebrities I met were Daryl Hall and John Oates. I had no idea who they were, and I'll never forget it because my boss said, "Ludwina, you got country written all over your face." And I was like, "Okay, I don't know who Hall and Oates are, so I've got three records, Charles." when I met Julian Lennon, that was actually quite significant, and that's where I met my friend Carmine, who is Carmine Rojas was his musical director, and Carmine was also the musical director for David Bowie World Glass Spider Tour, all of Rod Stewart's tours, and then Carlos Alomar, who wrote most of David Bowie's lead guitar riffs, you know, I met him when he was touring with Bowie. So, you know, it was kind of that era. Look, I just enjoyed their company and they enjoyed mine and I learned a lot from them and I have lots of great stories and my kids go, yeah, 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 and, you know, but I know that they tell their mates and my brothers, because I was able to get my brothers a lot of backstage passes and, you know, to concerts and stuff like that. So, you know, when we're all sitting around the fire in the country town, you know, around the big bonfire having drinks with all their mates, I go, oh, yeah, my sister got me into this concert and, you know, it's kind of all that. So it's fun.
At this point, you might be wondering just how Dukovic got into the business world, let alone the world of property. It's a transition that was unexpected for everyone, but at the same time, made perfect sense.
I guess in a nutshell is, apart from working in hospitality in my early years, I've actually been working for myself for 28 years. So I've never had a day job. I think I would be classified as unemployable. And I just love the idea of creating a concept, seeing if there's a market for it, testing it, developing it, and then selling it. So I really like that creative process. I think it fosters the creativity part of myself, but I also love the tech side of it because I'm quite analytical as well. So it sort of feeds both sides of who I am. When I first started, there was no internet, no mobile, no digital. So it was all back in the analog days. And I, after I had both of my children, I was 27 when I had my second one. So my late 20s, I decided I wanted to make a TV show just out of the blue, like why not? And I had no experience in production. I left school at 15, left home at 16. I just had a lot of chutzpah and gumption and just decided it's what I wanted to do. But what I did have was the ability to ignite my vision in a way that other people would come along for the journey and then I would find the people that had the skills that I needed to be able to fulfill that vision. And so that was really the first key moment that I realized I had that ability. And then from then on, you know, TV production and video production was a big part of my early career. Had quite a lot of successes with that, particularly in a program where I was sponsored by Apple and Optus to run a program in schools that I ended up running in over 300 schools in Adelaide, Brisbane and Melbourne over a period of about 5 years. So that was pretty phenomenal. That was called Media Minds. Again, that was back before digital came in and teachers had to teach media in grade 5 and 6, but they weren't actually learning how to teach media at university. So I came in and I essentially created a program that covered off all of their curriculum standard framework for media. And it was a wonderful experience for the kids. So that was an interesting next part of that journey. And then, of course, digital came in. And then at that point, I was in my early 30s, mid-30s maybe, and I was going through quite a lot of personal changes and growth in my life. And that was at the time when life coaching became a thing in Australia when it first became released. And from there, I thought, yep, this is something that I'm going to do next. And so I went into that, ended up then utilizing that skill and my previous business and marketing abilities to then work with women in business. So women in business back then was just a newly starting phenomenon, I guess.
While everyone has challenges to overcome to reach their goals, usually the hardest obstacles are outside of the mirror. Dukovic was faced with a different kind of fight.
You kind of have to remember that when I first became a mother, the conversations were, you know, should you be working outside of the home? and so as women started to develop businesses for themselves in from home particularly, there was a lot of my skills that I had learned with juggling children as well as my own businesses that I was able to support them. So then I started a national women's events company, as you do, to get clients in. And, you know, that was an amazing experience. We had networking events running around the country. And then cancer became part of my journey at that, about 5 years into that, which I'm now 12 years cancer-free, so I'll just say that. But, yeah, but that was I don't mean to be flippant about it, but that's another conversation in and of itself. But I was only 44 at the time, and when that occurred, I spent 3-4 years having surgeries. It was kidney cancer. I lost my kidney, but then had to have a few repair surgeries as well. But in that time, I had a lot of rest time, and in that rest time, I wanted to, I love learning. So I started to learn a lot about tech because tech was just coming in. And I also wanted to do something that wasn't going to, that would help to keep my business brand alive, that didn't require me to look good, feel good, or go anywhere. So I started podcasting in 2010. I did my first audio podcast. And that was back in the days when, yeah, I had to teach people how to download a podcast on iTunes. Hit number one half a dozen times, I think. I got screen grabs of it for evidence and new and noteworthy. And then people started asking me, well, you know, how do you do it? Can you teach me? And then I started to realize, you know, if I hear something three or more times, there's something, possibly something in it. So then I created the podcast masterclass. Then I had to have another surgery. And then I wrote a book on digital and marketing. And the following year I had to have another surgery, so I launched that book in digital and print worldwide. And then after that I started to pick up and then started working alongside some pretty significant people in the tech space. My reputation through interviewing leaders in the tech industry through the podcast opened up a big, you know, platform for me and doors, as I imagine it has for you as well. And the knowledge that I gained, plus the connections and the relationships, then started to, you know, really develop my mind in ways that I had never really thought of before, and led me more into, then started to invest in tech and then work within tech companies as an advisor.
In our last conversation with Dr. Vic, we explored her journey from country New South Wales to New York City. This journey involved a lot of bar work and celebrity encounters. Now, let's delve into how she transitioned into the business world and developed the necessary skills.
We had a bit of an unusual lifestyle because we made the choice to homeschool our kids as well. So, and this is back before digital and, you know, tech and everything. So the main reason why I ended up becoming self-employed was so that I could work and be at home with my kids. And then so my kids ended up getting quite involved in the production company that I had. And interestingly, my son became very interested in that sort of career, and that's where, you know, he's heading now in his life. And my daughter was probably more like very tunnel vision, and she'd sort of like want to study one thing each year, whether it was flowers or stones or cooking or makeup or whatever. And then we just had this interesting concept of this is what she was studying this year. And she's now very driven, very single focused. And, you know, she's 28 and has ridden a motorbike halfway around Australia on her own. She's a life model, which is what she does. She models for artists. She also does some work in the medical field, helping doctors with testing. And then my son works in film. He's a very traditionalist when it comes to film, like traditional film, and shooting on film. And so a lot of the learning that I did was also kind of integrated in their learning, and, you know, and then that they would incorporate their education, what I was doing in business. So they learn a lot about business as well when they were younger. And a lot of the soft skills and practical skills, you know, learn how to drive in a manual car and learn how to, you know, travel and budget and, you know, all those kinds of things that I think are really important that the kids do learn. But so my learning was really just, our household was just about learning. It was a real, always a learning environment. So that just became part of.
Even after being her own boss for nearly 30 years, Dukovic is still learning.
And I recently, as in a few years ago, I did the Clifton Strengths Report. And I highly recommend it for anyone. I was my corporate coach at the time that I still work with her, and she recommended I do it. And one of my top five strengths is learner. And it was really interesting to know that my number one strength is achievement. So I was just like, how can that be a strength? I was like, wow, that's why I feel so good every time I achieve something, even if it's small or big or whatever. It's just like, it really energizes me. Like if I had a big gong in this house, it would get whacked every time, you know. Relator, so obviously with people, maximizer and communication. And they are my five strengths. So it was actually, you know, really good to see it in that way and to understand myself in that as long as I'm doing these things, I feel fulfilled in my life. And when I don't, then I go back to it and it's like, okay, what can I do today? Just achieve something, even if it's small. just said, pep me up a bit. What's something that I can learn and study? Is there a piece of art I can finish so I feel like I've completed and achieved something, or, you know, things like that. So, yeah, learning's just always, and still to this day, it's just always a part of our household, even now that my kids have moved on. But they're always learning something, you know, which I really love to see, that they, the nature of learning for them has become embedded in their life. It's not something that, okay, they learned when they went to school and then they stopped learning after. They continually are learning.
When making the decision to homeschool her children, Dukovic made sure that she stuck to the curriculum while also incorporating some natural curiosity.
Well, there were a few assumptions that I'd make first. One is that they may not always want to be homeschooled. So if they did want to go back to school at some point, then what would be most important that they were at least up to speed in terms of the yearly curriculum that they would be put into. So maths was something that, you know, they had to, you know, every year make sure they're on top of that. But they'd get a year of maths done in 3 or 4 months for that year. So that didn't take much for them. The rest of it was incorporated a lot in curiosity and just learning. So whatever they wanted, through play. Children, adults as well, we learn through play, right? So when I... Yeah, so I'll... No, but just in just play in normal life. Like when I think about my art, like the amount of constant decision-making that happens every time I'm painting, every time I put my brush onto the canvas, there's a decision that's being made. The colours that I'm choosing, the composition that I'm deciding on, even firstly just figuring out what it is that I want to paint, where's that going to sit on the canvas? There's this... constant flow of decision making all the time that goes into that. And I'm playing when I'm painting, right? When I'm having a conversation with someone, to me that's play, because I love this back and forth of banter. I could probably do it with you all day, to be quite honest, Tyrone. I love the questions that you're asking me. So with the kids, it was like, well, what do you want to, you know, what do you, for, as I said, for Tiana, it was like she'd just pick a topic. And then you go down, they go to the library, they'd go to have conversations with people. We'd find people who were experts in that field. They'd get mentored by them. They had books that they would read. You know, it's just kind of like, how would an adult go and learn something? And that's how they would go and learn, right? And so you know, some of the work, some of the sciences and you know, writing maybe was a little more structured, but both of my kids have always had a huge passion for reading and writing. So that was just something that they did. As long as they were reading, then the writing just would flow from that. And we also were part of a very big homeschool network.
This homeschool network hosted a variety of activities that allowed for the children to apply their learned skills.
So sometimes we had circus days, or sometimes we'd go to a university and a chemistry professor would put on a day's workshop for our kids, or we'd go. There's all of these resources that are available to us everywhere, even more so now because of the internet. But essentially it's just looking at what are the resources around you, what do your children need to be balanced. Socialization, of course, is one of them. Let me just say that every school holidays, every time after school and on the weekends, we had kids at our house all the time, from the, you know, kids in the street. Or the kids would be with a homeschool network. We'd do that one day a week. Then we'd have family camps 3 or 4 times a year. Like, there was a whole lot going on all the time. It's something that you have to think about, but then, you know, you can choose a very structured environment like school at home, or you can choose a bit more of a natural learning kind of approach. But it's always in the back of your mind thinking, well, if they do want to go back to school, or which my son did, he did year 11 and 12, and then my daughter did year 10 for a couple of terms and then just found it very noisy and frustrating. So she stopped. But my son went to university as a mature age student. You know, Tiana, self-employed. What do you want for your kids? You know, you and I could go to university now just based on, you know, if we pass an entry test, we could go to uni. So there's always different ways to do things. But you have to definitely cultivate your lifestyle around it as a parent.
Moving towards the property side of Dukovic's journey, let's hear about how she created the room exchange.
We always had this thing about living within our means. You know, we'd have a house where the rooms were occupied. We wouldn't have houses where rooms wouldn't, because you'd be paying for them, right? So, you know, our first house was a two-bedroom single-fronted terrace in Richmond, and then our second house, we renovated, sold that, and we had one child at the time, and then I got pregnant, so I wanted, you know, slightly bigger place with a yard. We bought a place in Newport in Melbourne, big corner block, three bedrooms and seven fruit trees. That was awesome, big backyard. One of the rooms was used as an office. We had our room, and then the kids shared a room until they were 9 and 11. And then we thought, well, we need something a little bit bigger. So then we realised that, you know, the backyard was big enough we could probably subdivide. And so I did a bunch of research, and my husband and I had this kind of interesting conversation around it. He said, well, how are we going to build a house? You know, because we were just young and starting out. We didn't have a lot of money. And I said, well, look, if I can figure out how to build a house with no money, can we do it? And he said, yeah, go for it. And I figured it out. So I'd say yes and figure it out later, right? And so we built this, you know, gorgeous house, which we still own, and we rent that out, and we rent where we live in Williams Landing. And so when we went from there, and then we decided to rent after that, and that was a very specific decision because the house that we raised the kids in was feeling smaller as they were getting bigger. And my husband started working from home, or wanted to start working from home as well, so we needed more space. So we rented that, and then we rented our next place. And then when my son left home, and this is really interesting, so he was 22 when he first left home, and when I started seeing that spare bedroom in the house that we were renting empty, I started seeing it as a cost center. And I don't think that we look at space in housing in that way. Now, there are options. You can do Airbnb, which we did for a year, and it was a heck of a lot of work for $50 a night. But I love the experience of having random people coming into our house and experiencing the variety of people that came. But I didn't like the 4 hours it took to get the entire house hotel ready, right? That's a lot of work. But, you know, thanks to Airbnb, it was the beginning of something.
From here, Dukovic continued to have guests in her spare room.
My daughter had a friend who was traveling. We were doing some renovations on our rental property. He needed somewhere to stay. And I said, look, why don't you help Harry do some painting, and then you can live with us and we'll feed and house you. Just help him out on the weekend. So 8 hours over the weekend, and we'll feed and house you. And so that happened. And then over the course of the next few years, Tiana's random friends came, and it just kept happening. And it got to a point where I wasn't doing barely any housework. I'd just cook. They'd help us out 2 hours a day, and we'd feed and house them. And then some of my friends started saying, well, you know, where can we find someone? And then again, when I heard that 3 times, it was like, there might be something here. And that's when we did the research. And then Harry said, I think this is a potential to be a global platform. And I went, I think it does too. And he said, good, you're the tech person, you do it. And so it's like, and yeah, and that's kind of when it started from there.
The business had a focus on different ways to use spaces within your home.
That room is costing you, whether you're renting or whether you have a mortgage. If you had a commercial property, you wouldn't have space that you didn't need, because it would cost you money and it would affect your profit. So why do we do that with our homes? And we just tend to have gone through this phase over the last 10 years where let's just get all the space that we can, and let's have the theatre room and the rumpus room and the, you know, the triple garage or whatever else that we have, but there's only 2 people and maybe 1 baby on the way. And it's like, what? Yeah, it's crazy. And so it's like, well, what if that room could be, you know, used? In the early days, it was really about just using the room to get help at home. But then post-COVID, we've tweaked our model, and now we've realised that, you know, because it's the first time ever that there's been a rental crisis. In the 30 years I've been in property, this is the first time that we have a rental crisis. How in the heck did that happen? I don't know. But there are 13.5 million unused spare bedrooms in 10 million homes across Australia. That is existing housing stock, Tyrone. It's infrastructure. It's there. Now, they just so happen to be in homes where people live who don't typically see themselves as a flatmate, right? So it's not about flatmates. It's not about individuals coming together and renting a house together, because, mind you, there's very few of them available at the moment. This is about people who live in a home. Most of ours are homeowners. They bought the home. They've got all their stuff in the house. they're feeling a little insecure about, oh, yeah, I've never thought about renting it because I don't know who I'm going to get. So our platform, what we've done is we've provided all the security and the confidence for homeowners to go, well, every user has to have a digital ID by Australia Post, and we've integrated that through an API in our technology. We cover the cost of that. You've got to provide a government ID, photo ID. It has to match the information on the profile. If it doesn't, they can't connect with anyone. Everybody has to do that. Profiles make it easy for compatibility. So you want to feel like, for you, Tyrone, you want to feel whatever your personality and your partner's personality type is like, you want to feel like you can come home and still be that, right? That you don't feel like you have to change in the company of the other person who's there, and vice versa. So our profiles make it easy to be matched based on personality, values, and lifestyle. So you feel like you're coming home to a friend. And that person then adds value to your life. It doesn't remove from it, right? And then the third thing is that you can choose a traditional rental model. And mind you, a spare bedroom's worth $10,000 to $12,000 annually in rent, or up to 300 hours of household help, which we call rent offset. So you can choose rent or rent offset or a mix of both. It's completely up to you. So to give you an example of how it might work, my daughter has just left home for the fifth time. And now, you know, bedroom, it's a master. We have two master bedrooms in our house upstairs. We have one, obviously, and the other one was hers. And so it's a very, very large bedroom, fully furnished with an ensuite and a walk-in robe. And then there's a second living room upstairs as well. And so we're renting that for $250 a week. Now, whoever rents it, if they're happy to help me out 2 hours a week to sell a bunch of stuff on Facebook Marketplace, I'll knock off $50 a week rent. I'll rent offset, right? So think about it. You know, if they're happy to, and this is above what they would normally do to contribute as a housemate. So obviously everyone contributes to cooking and general cleaning around the house and things like that. But if on the Saturday, if my housemate and Harry and I are all doing, you know, 2 hours each of the big clean each week, we might say, well, look, if you're happy to do the whole 6 hours, take off the 2 hours you normally do, and that 4 hours will offset on the rent. You know, you can negotiate that. So if they're happy to do that and they can save money, and we're happy because we get more time back.
Cleaning is not the only way that housemates can offset their rent.
You might need your kids dropped off to school in the morning, or maybe picked up in the afternoon, or perhaps you and your partner want to go out on a Saturday night. You'd have to then go and arrange a babysitter, or maybe you're going on holidays. You'd have to arrange a house sitter because the person already knows your house and your pets. And, you know, there are so many benefits to it. And the culture, the language, the food that they bring, the stories that, you know, I love my husband, but 30 years of marriage, your conversations can be kind of the same. So it's nice having a third person there who wants to talk about something else, you know, without it having to be an arranged dinner party or something. You know, there's just, our kids have got stories of, you know, all these people that have come and lived and shared their life with us. And, you know, one of our taglines is sharing resources, sharing life one room at a time.
What is the difference between this living arrangement, a traditional share house scenario, or even couch surfing?
It's mid to long term. So this is not about short term stays. Although, you know, I'm happy to have someone just come for a month if they just need it for a month. In fact, with all the things that are going on with the flooding at the moment, I'm just about to put a call out if anyone needs, you know, just emergency accommodation for, you know, a few weeks while they get their stuff sorted out, they can come and stay at my place. Like, you know, there's, or, you know, we've had, the longest we had somebody here, I think, was 2 years. We had with someone who lived with us for 2 years. He was French Canadian. He was amazing. He just loved everything all being organized and tidied. Every single cupboard in my house was like, everything was perfectly folded. My husband's garage, I've never seen it like that since, but he just went in and completely organized it. But everybody brings something different. And I did an interview recently with two of our housemates who are in their 50s. One is, lost her husband about 5 years ago, and so was raising her 10-year-old on her own. And she was an epidemiologist at a hospital in Sydney, so she's working a lot. This was just pre-COVID. And then Cheryl Ann was starting a dance school in the eastern suburbs, and so she just needed somewhere that where she could, you know, it was ideal because she could save some money and still get to work and still help out with the child, and everything worked out really well. And then they were together through COVID, which was amazing. But one of the things that the Angela said, who was the owner of the house, she said, you know, Gigi says to housemate, what is it that you like to do? What are you good at doing that you enjoy doing? I'd much rather you do that and then I can hire a cleaner or I can hire somebody else to do something else. But what do you enjoy doing? And Cheryl Ann enjoyed spending time with her son and enjoyed, you know, the time in the garden and things like that. So that's the stuff that she focused on. And that's what we recommend. It's like, what natural skills do you have as a person? So if I was a housemate, I'm an artist. So it's like, well, you know, I could give you some art classes if you like.
It sounds like this type of living situation would work best with somebody who you're compatible with. But how does Dukovic ensure that the housemates are compatible?
Yeah, well, we've been told that the profiles pretty much give them a 75% confidence that that would be a good match. So first, they've got the fact that they've got a digital ID, so they know that they've been checked, and then they read the profile, and then we've got an inbuilt messaging system, which is private. So even at that point, so you can send a connect request with someone, and then that person will look at your profile. If they think they'd like to talk to you, then they'll accept it and they'll start messaging with you. So even at that point, they still don't have any private details about you. They don't have your surname, they don't have email address, phone number, nothing. And you can even use a preferred first name on your profile if you like. And that's on the public profile. And then from there, it's like, well, you go and meet in a coffee shop or, you know, have a phone call or do FaceTime, whatever it is that you feel confident with, and then go from there. The other thing is that we've had a bunch of people who kept asking us if we could help them find someone. And so we've recently launched a matching service as well. So we have a bunch of households who are now paying us to go through that whole process. And sometimes there might not be someone on the platform that really suits them, so we'll recruit them. We have ways of finding people that are ideal for these households. And then it's based on a no match, no fee. So if we don't find them a match, they don't pay. And if we do, then they pay. So it works out roughly the equivalent of 2 weeks' rent, which is we charge $499 for that matching service. And we do three-way video interviews and we, you know, give them the opportunity. I know when it works because I can't get a word in after 5 minutes. Like, it's just, they go at it. Yeah, they just go at it, yeah. And then we have another service that we're about to launch, which is a house share agreement service. So if once they've agreed that they're going to move in, then we'll do another three-way video call where we, and they'll print out the our template, and then we call them matches. Our matches will then ask them questions and the difficult questions that they might not be comfortable asking each other at that point. So things like, you know, what are the rules around having special friends over? Or what if I want to go away for a couple of weeks? What happens then? Or, you know, if either of us decides the relationship needs to terminate, how much notice do we need to give to each other? You know, what are the rules of the household? What are, you know, things like that that we'll go through, and they'll write that down, and they'll also get a recording of the video that we do, and that's an additional service that we charge to do that for them if that's what they want. And we seem to get that a lot with our elderly households, people that are elderly that are living on their own. We encourage, you know, their carers or their family members to get involved. But, you know, just people who haven't house shared before and they don't sort of feel confident in that process of going through it themselves, they can hire us to do that. And then they're not missing out on anything because the rent will, you know, cover the cost of it once they start renting. So there's that as well. But, you know, we've really done as much as we can through the use of technology. And then, you know, I remember back in the day, when you go to the pub and you're looking for a housemate and you saw an A4 poster with tear off phone numbers at the bottom. You might be old enough to remember that, yeah. Yeah, oh, okay. And so you tear it off and you go to the phone booth and you call them up and, hey, I'm just down at the pub. Oh, okay, I'll meet you down there and you have a beer and you sound all right, you can move in tomorrow. Right? There's no driver's license or no ID checks or anything like that. You just use your gut instinct, right? But, yeah, so, you know, but I guess because of there's so much media and social media and fear that gets instilled in people, everyone thinks that there's a murderer in every street that you live where, you know, I've never met one. I don't know anyone who has been harmed in that way.
Let's take a look at the benefits as a homeowner of renting out a spare room.
I guess it just depends on what kind of, what's the purpose for the property that you're purchasing. So if you're purchasing the property purely to rent the property out as a whole property, then, you know, we could we're not a real estate agent, so we don't do that kind of leasing process. So just to be really clear what we're not, obviously then go to an agent and get it rented in that way. If you're moving into the house, you're buying a property and you know that it's got one or two spare bedrooms, then you can consider, okay, well, I can get a housemate in. You also need to make sure that you talk to your accountant because it is additional income that you're earning on your home. So make sure that you're aware of those aspects of it. But then again, when you think about the amount of money that or help that you can get in terms of what the impact might be at the end result when you sell the place, I think you're way ahead in the short term there. So just have a think about that as well. We have actually just in the last month, three different property investors who are building co-living houses who are approaching us to find compatible housemates that they can actually put into these co-living houses. So that's another way that you can look at it. One of them in particular in Brisbane, he's building a five-bedroom place and he wants to have one of the rooms as a rent offset for someone to manage the household, if that makes sense. Right? Yeah. So, yes, almost in a way. Yeah, yeah. So they get to live there for free depending on the amount of time that they want to contribute to it. And then, you know, they keep the driveways clear, take the rubbish out, keep the main living areas clear, and then they have an opportunity to also get some additional work if they want to check in and check out people that come as well. So there's a number of different ways that you could use our service. Like there's one of the things that we're doing, as I said, is approaching government to, particularly in coastal towns where they're having a huge problem with finding accommodation for hospitality and service workers, because a lot of the properties in those towns are actually listed as short-term holiday platforms, it's really reduced the amount of rentals. So if anyone's a property investment thinking about it in that way, you know, maybe there's something that we could talk about there. But there's just, you know, we have to start looking at different ways of building and different ways of living, because the cost to buy a house is ridiculous unless we actually give our kids, you know, a few $100,000 to purchase their own home. There's no way that they'd be able to afford a mortgage in their life. You know, work has changed so much. The full-time job really is now broken down into a bunch of gigs or, you know, part-time jobs. And you know, there are some financial institutions who are kind of understanding that, but the traditional banks generally don't. More people are becoming self-employed. There's a whole lot of big changes that are happening across the board, and we've got to look at, you know, different ways of making housing accessible and affordable. But at the same token, how can we also help to reduce the stress of households who are experiencing massive interest rate hikes right now? You know, like being able to rent your room out would relieve that problem immediately. You know, so, you know, and then right now we also have a worker shortage in Australia. Because it's post-COVID and people are finding it virtually impossible to get cleaners or part-time childcare, gardeners, things like that. So there's a lot of benefits across the board. You know, we recommend that people do a trial for like a long weekend, you know, have the person come and stay before they forfeit their previous accommodation, you know, if you need that to finalise it off. But generally if people just come down to basic common sense, they can figure it out. You know, you figure out how to employ someone. You take on a risk when you say yes to hiring someone. There's responsibilities with that, right? You know, we're making decisions all the time about people. It's no different. The only difference is people say, yeah, but it's my home, it's my privacy. Well, what is it that you're needing to be private about? Is it that they, you know, perhaps you can actually, your life can become more fulfilling and more open and more joyous as opposed to you feeling like you're losing something.
Dukovic has already told us the stories of meeting numerous stars. Now let's hear about the mentors that helped her along her journey.
I could not have done what I've done without my advisors. And, you know, some of them are still with me from the get-go and, you know, some have come and gone because sometimes, you know, people are in your life for a reason, a season or a lifetime. I'm just so incredibly grateful because when I was saying earlier on in our conversation that, you know, I have a vision and it's like I decide I want to do it and then I figure out how to do it, making the decisions about how to do it need to be bounced around. Like they, you know, if I've not done it before, then I need to have the right conversations with the right people. And my advisors are great. Like my COO, Stav, it's his nickname. He's got a legal and a finance mind. And so like he'll often say to me, you know, if I'm upset about something and I have to send an email or I'm having a challenge with someone, he'll say, write the email to me first so you feel like you've said it, and then I'll edit it and send it back to you, then you can send it, right? So, you know, little things like that that are just really great that help to protect me and also help guide and teach me along the way on how to better manage, you know, difficult conversations or challenging times. But I really could not be where I am without them. You know, and then there's just people that pop into my world who are just people who are kind enough just to share kindness at that time. And that could be wisdom. It could be something that they do for me. It could be volunteering something. Like right now I have a group of women who are in their 50s who are just helping to introduce a room exchange around to all their different networks because they believe it's just such a great thing. And it's like, I'm so humbled by that, you know, like it's just amazing, you know, the things that people will do. And then there's the team that work with me on the, you know, the day-to-day tasks, and then, you know, my leadership team and then my advisors. It's just like it takes a circle. That's what I call it. And I explain it in this way where, you know, just imagine a flat circle. So I'm in the middle of the circle and then everybody is around me. You know, I'm not above them. It's not a hierarchical structure in that way. Some of them are closer to me because they're the leadership. Some of them a little further away, but we all have to work together for that circle to work. And in my mind, we're all as important as each other. Some of us have greater responsibilities, but that circle can't work unless we're all integrated together. And that requires care, it requires understanding, empathy. You know, right now my CTO's partner is about to have a baby at any moment, and then my lead developer, his brother's just been in an accident, you know. So it's like that's very difficult to manage as a CEO, but you have empathy and care for that. Those people have to come first before my needs right now, right? So, but because we care for each other, and the first thing we ask when we're, you know, connecting is like, how's the family? How's your partner? How are your kids? You know, what's going on? And it's just lovely that that's a culture that we've created. So I know it's kind of a long-winded answer to your question in terms of mentors, but the mentors come in, you know, my husband being my solid partner in this, and, you know, it's cost him, you know, it's been stressful. It's cost us a lot of money. It's cost us a lot of time. We're in our 50s, you know, it's not something that we planned on doing right now, but we didn't see it to be as big as what it was when we first started. So, you know, there's so many people that it's a question I can't even think to answer right now, other than my key advisors and my leadership team and just the people who work with me. I love them, you know, I really do. I care for them. Yeah.
Dukovic shares what she would tell herself 10 years ago before her journey of developing the Room Exchange.
I don't think I'd be wanting to be experiencing life any differently to how I am. If it wasn't the Room Exchange, it would be something else that was big. I don't like doing small things. Perhaps maybe not the level of stress and impact that COVID's had on it and all those things, but regardless of anything anything would have been affected. I'm proud of where my kids are, my relationship with my husband, you know, 30 years of marriage is not an easy achievement. It's not easy. You know, we were kids when we met, pretty much. You know, the fact that I'm healthy and I'm alive is something I'm always grateful for. And, you know, one of the greatest lessons I learned back then at that time, because I kept getting asked a lot by, you know, a lot of woo-woo people, what did you learn about yourself? What did you, you know, how are you going to live life differently? And it's like, well, you know, shit can happen anytime. That I'm certain of. It's not the shit that happens to you that determines who you are. It's how you deal with it. And it was, you know, giving myself permission to rest when I needed to rest, figuring out ways to still keep my mind active when I needed to, making sure that the people around me were feeling okay, because it puts a lot of pressure on everyone else when you're sick. I wouldn't change anything. I would not tell myself to do anything different, Tyrone. I'm 56 and I'm feel really blessed and fortunate, and just keep staying strong, Ludwina, you know, keep working through, and you push through, eventually you'll get to the other side. And I think success is something that you earn. You have to go through the hard times to have the right to get on the other side, because you know what it's like when people win the lotto, they waste it because they haven't had to work for it, you know. And my major goal here is to create accessible and affordable housing. I think it should be a right for every human being. I think if we do it smart, we can reduce a whole lot of social issues that should not be happening, and we'll have a much more happy and harmonious country and world.
So I guess maybe last question for you is, how much of your success that you've achieved right now is due to skill, intelligence and hard work, and how much of it do you think has been due to luck?
No, I don't think there's any luck. I don't think, persistence, resilience, definitely hard work. You know, I did some skills I have now that I didn't have when we started. I think that you just constantly have to be making choices and pivot all the time. You've got to be, self-awareness is the biggest thing, I think. The biggest thing that I have continually, I journal a lot, and that just gives me this level of awareness around how I'm feeling and what's going on and what's really true and what's false feelings, you know, things like that. But, you know, sometimes I started 5 years ago with the Room Exchange, and sometimes I think, gosh, was I too early? But then I thought recently, no, actually, I came at the right time, because those first couple of years where I made the mistakes that I made, and then we had COVID. Well, not just the mistakes I made, but also the learnings and the insights that I got. And then COVID came, and then we had the time to pivot and rebuild and fix some of the technical debt that was there, and then make some assumptions about what was happening after. And then now that we've come after, it's like what we now have formed into is what the market needs right now. But we wouldn't have, if I had started today with where we started 5 years ago, it wouldn't have been the right model for now, you know. So it's cost a lot of time, a lot of energy, a lot of money, a lot of, you know, a lot. But we are in such a strong place. And I think that, you know, for me as a founder and CEO 5 years on and here as dedicated and committed as ever, comes from my resilience and my commitment to this, and because I really truly believe in it. And you know, the market is telling us that, government's telling us that, you know, we can solve the government's problem, a lot of government's problems around housing right now. You know, all they have to do is partner with us, use us as a software as a service model, we've solved the housing problem. You know, there's a lot of solutions here, a lot of loneliness that's happening, a lot of elderly people aging at home, a lot of women over 50 who post-divorce don't have enough money to buy a house, may not get a rental property, but they can rent with somebody else. It's the same age as them. They can match up with someone who's like them. Families who need support who don't have, you know, their parents nearby. There's a whole lot of things that are happening in, you know, behind our front doors that this can help with. And I think stronger communities just make better communities.
Thank you to Ludwina Dukovic, our guest on this episode of Property Investory.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.